Chapter 47. The special delivery was loaded into the back of a Ugandan army troop carrier. It was guarded by a couple of soldiers and watched by two army technicians. Coach Kim rode shotgun with the driver as they left the Entebbe airport in the early morning. He had hoped to fly the shipment on a small cargo plane, like the one he and Echo Lam had hitchhiked on back in early December, but there wasn't enough room. Food and medicine took priority over everything else, and on this trip, he was delivering nothing but entertainment, courtesy of a wealthy Ugandan beer magnate who loved basketball and sponsored Kim's national teams. The 7-hour drive on gravel roads actually took 9, and when they rolled into Rhino Camp South, it was too late to set up. They had dinner and slept in an army barracks nearby. Early Thursday morning, the technicians scouted locations and found the best spot on a rise not far from the new school. A flat trailer was moved into position, and the technicians and soldiers began unpacking the screens. There were 2 of them, positioned on opposite ends of the trailer with the generator, transmitter, antenna, and miles of wires and cables between them. Brand new 150-inch Samsung 8K flat screens, the largest to be found anywhere in that corner of Africa. Coach Kim spent the day under a shade tree, watching the project unfold, and occasionally reading a paperback. He tried to call Echo in Atlanta, but there was no cell service. Late Wednesday night, after the managers reported that all players were accounted for, Lonnie eased out of his room and went to the hotel bar where Echo was waiting in a corner. So far, the team's hiding place in an Athens Holiday Inn had not been discovered by the media. Echo had watched the team practice at the University of Georgia and was staying at the hotel. They ordered beers and talked about the practice, Providence, a game plan. Lonnie laughed and said,
"Actually, when you're a one-man team, the game plan is pretty simple."
"What happens when he goes cold?"
"We don't score, and they run us out of the gym. I just wish that for one game someone else would get hot and score 20. Mitch or Murray, maybe even Dimitri from the corner. Take the pressure off Suli and soften up the defense."
"They're not great shooters."
"Tell me about it. And the more he scores, the more the others rely on him. They're turning down good looks to get him the ball."
"I talked to him for a long time this afternoon in his room, and he seems to be handling it well.
You're smart to keep him away from the media. It's a circus. Have you seen the cover of Sports Illustrated?"
"Just came out online."
"No.
What is it?"
"A photo of the kid soaring through the air, windmill dunking against Duke, elbow about 3 feet above the rim, with the caption, 'Sulimania.'"
"Clever. I know you're worried about him, but this is really pretty cool. He's in a good spot, and he knows it. Nothing has gone to his head.
Yet. His teammates are smothering him, watching everything closely. A great bunch of kids, Echo. I love these guys."
"You'll love them even more if they win the next 2 and take you to the Final 4.
They laughed and sipped and looked around. The bar was practically empty. Lonnie asked,
"What's going to happen to Suli, Echo?" "You talk to more scouts than I do. I'm too focused on the next game and don't have time to think past it."
"Remember Frankie Mocha, my summer assistant?"
Lonnie nodded and said,
"Sure. He's a scout for the Nuggets. Says the kid will likely go late in the first round. The upside is obvious, with the added potential of more growth and maturity. The downside is the unknown. Is he a flash in the pan, red hot for 15 games, then he's gone? It's happened before. What the scouts want to see is a bad game. No one hits 50% from behind the arc, so what happens when he doesn't hit and stinks it up?"
"Please, not now."
"I know. I'm just saying he doesn't have the track record of the other one-and-dones. Those 4 at Duke were on the radar when they were 15 years old. The other top prospects have at least 2 full years in college. Not Suli. So that's a concern, but not much. The scouts are as enamored as everyone else."
Lonnie smiled and took a sip.
"If I said thanks for making me offer him a scholarship."
"You have, and you are welcome. Sometimes we get lucky. You know, it's hard to believe that when I met him a year ago, he was 6'2",
weighed $170, and had the ugliest jump shot in South Sudan.
He's a freak, Echo. Plain and simple. We measured him last week. 6'8" now. 230. All he wants to do is shoot baskets and lift weights.
Girls, I don't get involved, but I'm sure he's doing okay. Have you talked to him about the draft and agents and all that?
No, not yet. I know the runners are out. It's part of the business. At least three have approached Murray.
I've lectured the team in front of Sully and talked to the seniors when he's not around. They try to protect him, but you know how it works. As soon as the tournament is over, he's fair game and can talk to an agent. Once that starts, he's gone.
Nobody can turn down the money.
Echo agreed.
And he worships Niolo,
who turned pro at 19 after only 1 year at Syracuse. Of course, Niolo played competitive high school ball here in the States and was even an All-American. Trivia, who was the only high school prospect ranked ahead of Niolo?
LeBron.
LeBron.
And he didn't go to college.
What does Sully want?
We talked about his family this afternoon. That's all he cares about right now. He's eternally grateful to you and Central and his teammates, but when he's off the court, he's thinking about his mother and brothers. I told him that a coaching buddy of mine in Uganda has pulled some strings with the government, and they're setting up some big flat screens to watch the game in the refugee camp.
Can you imagine? Sully's mother and brothers watching him play? The kid had tears in his eyes when I told him.
That's amazing. And you got it done?
Sure, it's nothing. You ask what he wants. If money will help get his family over here, then he'll take the money. If earning a degree in 4 years and becoming a U.S. citizen will make it happen faster, then that's what he wants.
He'll take the money. Probably. He trusts you, Echo.
Do you know a good agent?
I'd rather not get involved.
At that point, Sully will enter a different world, and any advice from me would not be valuable. He's a smart kid, and he'll figure it out.
Hopefully.
When Samuel stepped into the mid-court circle for the tip, he took a second to soak in the enormity of Atlanta's State Farm Arena, home of the Hawks. Under one backboard, a noisy contingent from Central chanted his name, while the rest of the 18,000-plus settled into their seats. As always, he reminded himself of where he came from and how far he had traveled. A year ago, he was playing on dirt courts. He nodded to the center for Providence, a gangly boy with heavy feet, and slapped the ball back to Mitch Rocker, who took his time and quickly noticed that there were two Friars sticking to their star. The other three were spread across the lane in what appeared to be a zone of some sorts. Mitch drove to the free throw line and kicked out to Dimitri, who missed an easy 20-footer. More misses soon followed, and the double team on Sully worked beautifully, as long as no one else could score. Central was off to a dismal start, one that turned ugly when the Friars' leading scorer hit his second three to make the score 12-2. At the first TV timeout, the lead was 26-6, and Sully had yet to score. The crowd was quiet, but there was a buzzing as if the fans were wondering about all the hype. With one defender stuck to his back and the other staying between him and the ball, Sully was having trouble. Out of frustration, he elbowed the taller one and got a whistle, his first foul. They picked him up in midcourt and dogged him every step. Mitch Rocker hit a three, and after a block by Sully, Murray hit another one. At 13:05, Sully managed to take a bounce pass at the free throw line and spring high above his defenders. He was checked hard, got a whistle as the ball went in, and finished off the three-point play. He was on the board, and the lead was 15. Roy Tice took a long rebound and fired the outlet pass to Murray, who flipped it behind his back to Sully, who launched a 30-footer that hit and fired up the crowd. Providence slowed down the game, and both defenses settled in. Coach Britt chewed relentlessly on the refs, complaining that Sully was being held and hacked and otherwise mugged. He got a call, then another, and coverage slacked off just enough to spring him. He hit two more threes, and Providence called time at 7:40. Its lead cut to 8 points. Lonnie told Mitch and Murray to start hammering the ball inside and try to take pressure off Sully. Roy Tice hit two short jumpers, and the Friars missed four straight.
Sully missed badly from long range, but followed it, got the rebound, and fired a perfect pass to Melvin Montgomery for the dunk. At the half, the score was tied at 40. Sully had 12 points and was 3-for-7 from behind the arc. More important, he was keeping the Friars preoccupied on defense, and his teammates were scoring. On the other side of the world, Beatrice, James, and Chol stood at the front of a massive throng of refugees and watched the flat screen in disbelief. Before the game started, a Ugandan commander had welcomed the crowd and explained that the game was being brought to them in living color as a courtesy of his government. He talked about the game, a little about the tournament, and introduced, as the guests of honor, the family of young Samuel Suleiman, the hottest player in America. Beatrice never stopped crying. In the locker room, the Eagles were sky high. They had clawed back from a disastrous start and had momentum. Lonnie implored them to dig deep and contest every shot. It was only a matter of time before Sully took control. He wasted no time. The Friars' first shot bounced off the rim, and Dimitri scooped up a long rebound and sprinted with the ball. He found Sully across court with a bounce pass, and before anyone could get near him, he shot from 29 feet. Nothing but net. It was the shot the crowd had been waiting for, and the fans came to life. After a short bucket on the other end, he fought off his defenders, went up again, and was fouled hard. He made 2 of 3, and Central immediately pressed full court. Murray drew a charge. On the inbound, Sully sprinted from beneath the basket, took a pass at the top of the key, spun in midair, and hit from 20 feet. Providence scored, and Mitch jogged the ball up court. As Sully peeled off a low screen, one of his defenders grabbed his jersey, and a ref saw it. Third foul. Time to rest. Inbound, Murray found Sully deep in a corner for his 5th 3-pointer. Providence needed to regroup, but the coach decided to wait for the under-16-minute timeout. He should not have. The Friars were being pressed hard and taking bad shots. Mitch Rocker hit a 3, and Central had its first double-digit lead, 53-42. Its bench was wild, and most of the 18,000 fans were cheering for the Eagles. After the timeout, the Friars settled down and hit 2 buckets. Sully missed from 25 feet, followed it, missed the rebound, and Central gave up an easy fast break. Its lead had been cut in half. At 9:20, and up by 7, Sully squared up from 28 feet and nailed it. He hit another long one, then missed one, but drew a foul. With 8 minutes to go, he missed a bad one, and Lonnie yanked him for a breather. For 2 minutes, he watched Providence score 6 straight, and when he re-entered at 5:50, the score was 63-56, and the game was still in doubt. But his 2 defenders were dragging and tired of chasing him around the court. He hit his 6th 3, then his 7th. When he hit his 8th at 4:45, Providence called time, down 72-58, and out of gas. Central kept pressing and running, and Sully, already with 34 points, kept bombing away. When he hit from 30 feet, the crowd began chanting his name, and the arena was rocking. He finished with 40 in a 15-point win. The Eagles were 1 game away from the Final Four. Chapter 48. The game ended at 2 in the morning, East African time, and Coach Kim found a Ugandan sergeant with a sat phone. He called the number of an American cell phone. Sully was sitting high in the cheap seats of State Farm Arena with his teammates and coaches, watching Iowa State play Maryland in the 2nd game, when his phone buzzed with a strange number. Seconds later, he was talking to his mother. There was little time to enjoy being a member of the Elite Eight. On Friday, the team slept late, went through a light workout in an empty Stegman Coliseum on Georgia's campus, covered the scouting report on Maryland, and watched, off and on, the 4 games from the other side of the bracket. On Saturday, they slept late again, had brunch at the hotel, and took the bus to the arena in downtown Atlanta. In perfectly matched practice gear, they enjoyed a light shoot-around 2 hours before tip-off. The media was everywhere, and they hammed it up for the cameras. With Coach Britt close by, Sully met with some reporters at courtside and fielded all the usual questions. As he smiled and went through an aw shucks routine, his teammates chanted in the background, "Sully, Sully, Sully." One challenge of being the Cinderella team was the nonstop attention, and their coaches relaxed and let them enjoy the moment. Several reporters noted that they were far more laid back than the Maryland team, who were 8-point favorites. Sully easily won the tip. The Maryland center gave a half-hearted effort because a well-disguised steal worked perfectly, and Mitch was stripped of the ball. A quick pass down low led to an easy dunk. Maryland had 7 losses, with 5 of them in the Big Ten, a powerful conference that had landed 6 teams in the tournament. 3 of them had advanced to the Elite 8, the most of any league. The Terps were ruthless on defense and had allowed only 61 points a game, 2nd nationally to Virginia. They immediately went into a box and won, with 4 guarding the lane. The 5th, Omar Brazil, was the Big Ten Defensive Player of the Year, and he picked up Sully at midcourt and began talking trash. He would soon stop. Sully circled wide, took a bounce pass from Murray, and launched from 30 feet. Brazil was 6'6", about a foot shorter than necessary, and when the ball left Sully's hands, his defender was far below him. Nothing but net, and a taste of what was coming. Maryland was patient on offense and showed no desire to start running with the Eagles. With 4 seconds left on the play clock, a shot bounced off the rim. Dimitri Robbins grabbed the rebound and in midair, whirled and fired a pass to Mitch, who led Sully perfectly. He pulled up from 25 feet and drained his 2nd 3. Maryland missed again, and Murray sprinted the ball up court. Brazil got caught by a hard screen. His man was wide open, and when Sully hit his 3rd 3 in the first 90 seconds, the crowd began to chant. Central hit 7 of its first 8 shots, and at 14:55, the first TV timeout, led 18-7. Maryland was too experienced to panic and stayed with its controlled offense. The game slowed considerably as the Terps chipped away. Sully missed 2 bombs but drew the first foul on Brazil. The 2nd came quickly as he banged into Melvin Montgomery on a screen. It was a close call, and the Maryland bench was not happy. Brazil stopped yapping and realized he would spend the rest of the game hopelessly chasing Sully around the court and fighting off screens. When Sully hit his 5th 3 at 7:20, Maryland called time. Central was up 34-24. Sully had 22 points and was 5-for-8 from behind the arc. The team was shooting 70%, a torrid pace that Coach Britt knew would not be sustained. He told the other 4 to clear the lane so Sully could take it to the rim. Maryland patiently worked its offense and hit a 3. When Sully got the ball at midcourt, he dribbled twice, head-faked, got Brazil in the air, and rushed into the paint. As the defense collapsed, he rifled a behind-the-back pass to Mitch Rocker, who was wide open from 20 feet. He missed, and Maryland slowly brought the ball up. Both teams cooled off, trading misses and short baskets. With 2 minutes to go, Maryland began pressing and forced 2 turnovers. The Terps finished in a rush and, at halftime, trailed by only 4. 41-37. Sully had 24 points and was 5-for-10 from long range. More important, Brazil had 3 fouls. During the break, Coach Britt drew up 2 plays designed to draw the 4th foul. At that point, Sully could go wild. Maryland missed its first shot of the 2nd half. Mitch set the offense and bounced a pass to Sully, who was standing in the midcourt circle. He waved his teammates to the right side, as if no one else was on the court but him and Mr. Brazil. He faked a shot, and when Brazil didn't take it, he launched from 32 feet and drained it. Maryland killed the clock and hit a short jumper. Sully set up at the free throw line with Brazil stuck to him like glue. At 15 seconds, he spun around and took his man through 3 hard screens as he sprinted to a corner. Brazil fought through the screens, but lost a 2nd. When Sully went up from 22 feet, Brazil was airborne and fell into him for his 4th foul. For once, the play worked exactly as Coach Britt had drawn it up on the board. Sully hit 2 of 3 free throws. With Brazil on the bench, Maryland put 2 men on Sully, and this delighted him. Somebody else had to be open, and Murray, perhaps the weakest shooter on the team, found the hot hand. When he hit 2 straight 3s, Central was up by 52-39, and Maryland called time. Each trip down the floor became another adventure in Sully mania. The entire defense watched him. When he couldn't get the ball, Mitch worked it low for easy buckets by Melvin Montgomery and Roy Tice.
When Sully got the ball, usually around midcourt, he dazzled his defenders with lightning-fast dribbles and either launched long fadeaway jumpers or slashed to the basket where he drew fouls or finished with highlight reel dunks or dished off to his teammates. At 6:02, Brazil re-entered the game during a TV timeout. His team was down 16, 68-52, and the crowd was yelling for more. As loud as it was, the noise inside the State Farm Arena paled in comparison to the constant roar of the masses on the outskirts of Rhino Camp South. Every long shot made by young Samuel sent his people into unrestrained delirium. Beatrice, James, and Cho were treated like royalty and nearly mobbed with each magnificent play. Up 20, 76-56, Sully came out for a breather, and Maryland put on its inevitable last run. The Terps scored 8 straight, and Coach Britt called time at 3:35 to settle down his team. Sully re-entered and promptly missed a long one. Maryland did the same. Mitch was called for traveling, and Maryland kicked one out of bounds. Both teams took a deep breath and braced for the last 2 minutes. Mitch called the same triple screen to free Sully, and when he hit from 28 feet, Maryland was on the ropes again. Roy Tice blocked a shot, and the ball landed in Murray's hands. He flung a high, long pass down court where Sully streaked all alone, nonchalantly took in the ball, and stuffed it. Maryland inbounded with a long pass that caught the Eagles off guard and led to an easy layup. The Terps swarmed the inbound pass, but Mitch cleared the press with a long pass of his own to the other end where Sully was open. He could have killed some clock, or waited to be fouled, or passed across court to avoid a foul, but instead, he instinctively went up from 29 feet and drained it. Coach Britt chose not to back off, and the Eagles pressed relentlessly. Maryland barely cleared midcourt in 10 seconds and quickly threw up a brick. Roy Tice grabbed the rebound and was fouled. He made both free throws, and the game was over. When the bus rolled onto the central campus late Sunday afternoon, the students were waiting. They lined the streets, cheering wildly, waving signs, throwing confetti. When the bus stopped in front of the Nest, barricades protected the players and coaches as they stepped off and soaked in the moment. Half a dozen news vans were parked haphazardly to one side, and there were cameras everywhere. Inside, the place was packed and rocking as 4,000 students and fans filled the stands and covered the floor, all waiting for a glimpse of the school's first Final Four heroes. When Mitch led them through the tunnel and into the mob, the familiar chant of "Sully, Sully, Sully" shook the old gym. Chapter 49. For the second straight Monday morning, Lonnie found himself in the president's office, along with the AD. The president, always a busy man, had canceled all his important meetings. Everything else could wait. They reveled in their success and replayed the prior weekend's games. They talked about the trip to Phoenix, travel plans, tickets, and so on. Delightful details they never dreamed they would have the chance to discuss. Lonnie surprised them when he said, "Look, I really want to get the team out of town and as soon as possible. The distractions are already overwhelming. I've stopped answering my phone and can't even look at my emails. Everybody wants a piece, and Sully is the main attraction. We've got to protect the kid." "You want to leave now?" the president asked, feigning disapproval, but knowing damned well where this was headed. "Today. Forget classes this week. Don't think for a minute that these kids will be able to study. Hell, they can't even go to class. We need to go hide somewhere to practice and get away from this craziness."
"You have someplace in mind?" asked the AD.
"Yes. I have a buddy who coaches at Northern Arizona in Flagstaff, about 2 hours north of Phoenix. I talked to him last night, and he's on board. He'll arrange hotel rooms under his name and give us his gym for the week. We cannot practice here. It's impossible."
The president offered the standard frown and asked,
"And miss an entire week of classes?"
"Absolutely. It's imperative. Get the deans on board, talk to their professors, and I'll make sure they keep up online. They'll have plenty of time when we're not in practice. I'll make it work."
All three knew the score. Lonnie's team had just collected another $2 million for the school's athletic programs, and he would get whatever he wanted. The president shrugged as he caved. The AD said, "I assume you'll want an airplane this time?" Lonnie laughed and said, "Well, Sully asked about taking a bus, and I thought the guys might choke him." "I'll bet they don't," the president said. Lonnie said, "No, that won't happen. They are being extremely protective." "Where is he?" "In Ida Walker's basement. She's standing guard, but she's a bit rattled. Word's out, and there were people knocking on her door last night." The AD said, "Let's get him out of here." The president said, "Agreed. You have the university's full support in every way." "Thank you," the AD said.
"And you do prefer to fly?"
"Yes." When the team boarded the bus Monday afternoon, not a single player knew where they were going. They had been told what to wear and what to pack, and they watched with amusement as the driver followed the signs to the Raleigh-Durham airport. At the General Aviation Terminal, they got out and were directed to a private charter waiting on the tarmac. They grew more excited as they took their seats. Mitch Rocker finally asked, loudly,
"Say, Coach, where are we going?"
"To Disney World," Lonnie replied. "Until we get there, I want every one of you to hit the books."
Studying was the last thing on their minds. After takeoff, the cabin's in-flight navigational system was turned off, and all screens went blank. It was obvious, though, that they were headed west. 4 hours and 2,000 miles later, they began a descent and saw mountains and deserts, rarities in their world, which confirmed the suspicion that they were headed to Arizona. After the plane landed and was taxiing to the terminal, Lonnie addressed the team and laid out the plan for the week. He instructed them to keep their location and practice schedule secret. Nothing on social media. On Tuesday, they practiced early and hard at the walk-up sky dome on the NAU campus, then relaxed and watched an hour's worth of film of Villanova, their Saturday opponent. The Wildcats were the number one seed in the East. The other two teams were Oregon, from the West, and Kansas, from the Midwest. After lunch, they suffered through a one-hour study hall, then boarded a bus and rode an hour to a national park where a giant meteor had landed 50,000 years earlier and changed the landscape. Far from home, the players and most of their coaches had never seen such a rugged and beautiful landscape. They took hundreds of photos, but were strictly forbidden from posting anything on social media. At night, after dinner, they hung out in their rooms and watched and listened as the commentators and talking heads went on and on about the Final Four. The Eagles and their improbable run to Phoenix were the main topic. Their stories and angles varied little. The other school from Durham taking on established programs. The first historically black college to make it so far. The show-stopping play of Samuel Suleiman, a freshman freak, averaging 41 points a game, a modern tournament record, a one-man team against far superior talent. Early Wednesday morning, Sully talked to his mother and listened with great pride as she described watching him play with tens of thousands of other refugees. He was the pride of South Sudan, or at least of his scattered people. Wednesday and Thursday followed the same routine: hard work in the mornings, bus rides in the afternoon. The highlight was a trip to the Grand Canyon. On Friday, the team rode the bus 2 hours into Glendale to the University of Phoenix Stadium, home of the NFL Cardinals. Their coaches had shown them photos of the Space Age Stadium, indoors and out, and had tried to brace them for the shock of seeing a tiny basketball court in the middle of such a vast venue. But the shock wore off as they went through a light shoot-around. Cameras were everywhere, and the players thoroughly enjoyed the attention. Afterward, a crew from CBS interviewed the players, with most of the attention directed at Sully. Lonnie had been criticized for hiding his team, but he didn't care. Once in the glare, they opened up and said all the right things. With his ever-present smile and good nature, Sully became the darling of the press. Back at the hotel, they watched a movie until 11, then all lights were out. At 10 Saturday morning, they enjoyed a catered brunch in a large conference room while Coach Britt reviewed the game plan and matchups. At noon, they boarded the bus for the return to Glendale. At 2:30, they ambled onto the court and began stretching and warming up. The Villanova players were at the other end, doing the same, and some of the players eventually met in the center and said hello. Coach Jay Wright walked over and introduced himself. The mood was light, even festive, and the Wildcats were an amiable group. Sully chatted with Coach Wright, who introduced him to Darryl Whitley, their All-American forward. With a smile, Whitley said, "I got you, man." Sully replied, "And I got you." It was a dream matchup the pundits had been discussing for a week. Whitley was a junior, averaging 20 points and 10 rebounds, and was expected to go high in the draft. The Central coaches had watched hours of film and were of the opinion that he occasionally relaxed a bit on defense. Not surprisingly, they planned to go to Sully. Back in the locker room, the team changed into its maroon road uniforms and tried to relax. Most of the players wore headphones or earbuds and listened to music. Sully checked his phone and was delighted to see a text that read, "Best of luck, Samuel. I am very proud of you. Leave it all out there on the court." It was his third text in 2 weeks from Niolo. He replied with a quick thanks. When it was time to play, Lonnie huddled his team around him and told him how much he loved them. Win or lose, they had come together and made history. They were the pride of their school, their families, their state, and all those black colleges and universities that had always struggled to get this far. For the rest of their lives, they would not forget what happened out there in the next 2 hours. The world was watching. Go have some fun. Chapter 50. The Walkers, Ida, Ernie, Jordan, and Brady, sat 10 rows behind the bench in the heart of the Central faithful. Like most of the fans present, they had never watched a basketball game with 75,000 others in such an enormous venue. Ernie didn't like it at all. The court was too far away. Everything was too far away. He could barely hear the band. Ida finally told him to shut up and enjoy the moment. On the other side of the world, Beatrice and her boys were once again led by smiling soldiers to the front of the pack and given seats of honor. Masses of humanity squeezed closer to the trailer and its 2 large screens. Even those who could barely see were happy to stand shoulder to shoulder and listen to the American announcers set the stage. It was late on a Saturday night, with a full moon above. Tomorrow was Sunday, just another day to survive until Monday. Being introduced in such a spectacle was intimidating enough. Being introduced as thousands chanted, "Sully, Sully, Sully," was overwhelming. But he managed to appear loose and kept smiling at everything. Central was clearly the crowd's favorite. The starters met at midcourt and shook hands in a variety of ways. Villanova's center, Wade Lister, was 7 feet tall and could jump. He had controlled every tip of the season, and Sully was no match. When he got pinched in a ball screen, Darryl Whitley calmly drained a 20-footer, and the Wildcats struck first and fast. Everyone watching the game knew what was coming. Sully posted low, then busted through the lane with Whitley fighting off screens. Murray bounced a perfect pass that Sully took on the way up from 30 feet. When the ball swished the net, the crowd, half a second behind because of the distance, exploded. Nova missed from the arc. The rebound went long, and Mitch Rocker took it on a fast break. As the lane closed, he whipped a gorgeous pass behind his back, and Sully was in the air again with his second 30-footer. He looked unstoppable, but, of course, he was not. In the college game, it's rare for a gunner to hit 40% from long range. No one has ever hit 50% for a season. After 19 games, Sully was at 46%. For the tournament, he was at 51%, a remarkable number that was not sustainable. It was time for a drought, and its timing could not have been worse. He missed his next 2 attempts, and the crowd settled down.
Whitley was quick and fearless on defense and slapped one ball out of bounds. When Sully tried to drive, he lowered his shoulder a bit too much and drew the charge. He missed again from downtown, and the offense sputtered. At the first time out, Nova was up, 14-6. Feeling the pressure, Sully missed a bad shot from 20 feet, and Darryl Whitley hit a quick three on the other end. Murray missed, then Mitch followed with another miss. The Eagles couldn't buy a bucket, and their star was ice cold. Behind, 22-6, Lonnie called timeout. The crowd was silent. Had the clock finally struck 12 for Cinderella? For the last 8 minutes of the half, Central played some of its worst basketball of the season, or perhaps the difference in talent became obvious. Villanova played a tight team defense and was patient on the other end, rarely taking a low-percentage shot. With its scorer neutralized, Central began to panic on offense and committed turnover after turnover. With 5 seconds to go, Sully finally hit another three to cut the lead to 41-24. He had 11 points for the half, but hit only 3 of 10 from behind the arc. The Eagles' locker room was frustrated, tense, and frightened. Frustration at the sloppy play, fear that the magical run was finally coming to an end. Was this their destiny? To capture the headlines with a miracle run behind a former redshirt who seemed invincible, only to flame out at the end when the competition became too much? There were appeals from Mitch Rocker and Roy Tice, both seniors. Coach Grinnell gave an inspiring speech. Coach Britt thought a 2-3 zone might work. However, everyone knew the truth. If Sully wasn't hitting from downtown, they had no chance. He drew his third foul at 18:40 on a close call that upset Lonnie, who wasn't about to pull him out. He told him to back off and, by all means, avoid another foul. Sully immediately hit a three, then another, and the stadium came to life. But Nova was too well coached and experienced to panic. It ran its offense, double-teamed Sully when necessary on defense, and extended its lead. At 9:25, the score was 58-39, and a last-minute push by Central looked unlikely. Nova, with a much deeper bench, subbed freely and was wearing down the Eagles on defense. A minute later, Mitch Rocker limped off the court with a high ankle sprain. Nova immediately pressed full court, and Murray struggled to handle it. Sully helped break the press and was open from 35 feet. It was a bad miss on a shot he should not have attempted and showed how desperate the Eagles were. Through nothing but determination, they stayed within 20 points but could get no closer. At 2:44, and needing a miracle, Sully got open from 25 feet. If the ball went through the rim, another wild streak might be in the works. Think the Duke game, 5 threes in 58 seconds. When it rattled out, Nova cleared and walked the ball up court, ahead 71-50. Central pressed at midcourt, but Nova handled it easily. A dunk put the game out of reach. Sully wasn't much for tears. He had shed buckets of them in the past year, but for real losses, real tragedies. Crying after a basketball game cheapened the tears he had shed for his family. He and the Eagles hung around the court and congratulated the Wildcats, who were great sportsmen and said all the right things. Sully did a quick interview courtside with CBS and managed his trademark smile. He blamed himself for the loss and said he had not played well, but it had been a wonderful run for him and his underdog buddies, and they were proud of what they had accomplished. They held their heads high. They had been beaten by a better team. When they were finally together in the locker room and the doors were shut, Lonnie smiled at his players and said, "Ain't nobody crying in this locker room, you hear me? Just think back to last September when we started practice. Not a single one of us in our wildest dreams could imagine we'd be here right now. We accomplished something that's never been done before. You made history, man, and that can never be taken away from you. I love you. Your coaches love you. Let's savor the moment and keep our heads up." They managed to sit through the first half of Oregon versus Kansas, but they had enough basketball for one day. Their season was over, and they really didn't care who played for the title on Monday night. Mitch, taped up and limping, asked Coach Britt if they could leave. The bus took them to a fancy Phoenix steakhouse where a private room had been reserved. Central's president and his wife were there, along with the AD and some other important people.
The coach's wives joined the party. As Sully was finding a seat, Echo Lamb walked through the door and hugged him. They sat together at a table with Murray and Dimitri and talked about the game. Sully scored 22, almost 20 below his tournament average. There was no doubt that had he been hitting, the game would have changed dramatically. He made only 5 of 16 attempts from three-point range. He turned the ball over 4 times. He had no blocks and only 6 rebounds. It was a subpar performance on every level, and he had no explanation for it. The setting was intimidating at first, but then every other player had the same jitters. They were playing a good team, but they had already beaten several others. There was no excuse, no explanation. Just a bad night. Echo tried to lighten the mood with, "You know, it was almost a year ago when I first met you in Juba, at the tryouts. Hard to believe, isn't it?" Sully smiled and nodded along. Echo looked at Murray and said, "He was only 6'2", wasn't too skinny, and could jump to the moon but couldn't hit a layup." Murray said, "Oh, don't worry, coach. He's told us how great he was back in Africa." "But he wasn't. He was the last person chosen on our summer team. Did you ever know that, Samuel?" "No, you never told me. I had 2 assistant coaches at the tryouts, and neither of them wanted to pick you. Our last slot almost went to Rick Quall, that 6'10 kid from Upper Nile. Remember him?" "Sure. I was convinced he would make the team." "Why'd you pick Sully?" Dimitri asked. "I don't know. He was pretty rough around the edges, like many of the African kids. Early one morning during the tryouts, I found him in the gym shooting all alone. It was hot and he was soaked, but I could tell he loved what he was doing. Just firing away, jogging after the ball, shooting again. He could do it for hours. Plus, I knew his mother is a tall woman and that he would probably grow. I had no idea he'd spike 6 inches in a year. No one saw that coming. I rolled the dice. Glad I did. Then I convinced Lonnie to roll him again. And here we are." "Coach Britt didn't want to sign him?" Dimitri asked. "Well, you know Coach Britt. He and I go way, way back, and we've been close friends for a long time. The story he likes to tell now is that he saw Samuel in Orlando at the tournament and knew immediately that the kid had a lot of potential. Trouble with that story is that there were 100 other coaches watching and no one saw the talent. No one else made an offer. When Central suddenly had an extra scholarship, I asked Coach Britt to take a chance. To his credit, he did." By late Sunday morning, the players were tired of the hotel. They held a team meeting and discussed their plans with their coaches. They could certainly hang around and watch the final game Monday night, then fly back Tuesday morning. But they wanted to go home. Part 3. Chapter 51. On a beautiful spring day in early April, a Wednesday, Sully rose early and slipped out of his dorm room to call his mother. Murray, always the deadhead, heard nothing and didn't move. They had moved back to the dorm for 2 reasons. First, they had grown tired of living with Miss Ida and Ernie and their bothersome expectations. Second, and far more important, was the fact that the dorm was filled with admiring girls who enjoyed hanging out in their room. The benefits of stardom were quite satisfying. Murray was happy to share in reflected glory. Beatrice said she and the boys were doing okay with little change in their routines. They were sad that the season had ended so abruptly and worried about Samuel's disappointment, but they were determined to survive until tomorrow. Samuel confessed to his mother that the end of the season was a huge letdown. Suddenly gone was the focus, the daily challenge, the structure of a schedule, the dream of winning and advancing. The weather was turning warm, spring was beautiful, but basketball was behind them. His mother would be completely unable to understand the decisions facing him. Leaving college early, hiring an agent, entering the draft, turning pro, or forgoing it all and returning to Central for another year or two. So he did not burden her with such talk. After 15 minutes, the pleasant Christine took the phone and said goodbye. Making as much noise as possible, Sully showered and dressed and left the lights on, and in doing so did not provoke the slightest twitch from his roommate. He left the dorm early and went for a long walk on campus, one that would not be possible in a couple of hours. He made it to the Nest without being stopped once by a student wanting a photo. Coach Britt was waiting in his office with Coach Grinnell. Dressed casually in golf shirts and sweats, they were sipping coffee and appeared to have been talking for a long time. There were so many postseason rumors roaring through the internet that their lives were unsettled. However, one important decision had to be made soon. Lonnie said,
"You have less than a week to make your decision, Samuel. What are you thinking?"
The NCAA was toying with ways to keep underclassmen in college. One idea was to allow them to hire an agent on a temporary basis, go through a workout, and get evaluated by a panel of experts who would rate their chances in the draft and call it off if things didn't look too promising. They could then stay in school and not lose eligibility. But this was just a proposal. At the moment, if Sully hired an agent and entered the draft, there was no turning back if it proved disappointing. He could probably make a buck playing in Serbia or Israel, but his college playing days would be over. He loved Central and everything about college life. It was the only home he knew, and the thought of leaving was unsettling. However, he was devouring everything he could find online about the draft, player projections, lottery picks, agents, rookie contracts, the millions of dollars waiting out there, and the stars like Kobe and LeBron and Kevin Garnett, who turned pro after high school and never bothered with college. He had found a dozen stories about good players who'd stayed in college, only to see their careers ruined by injuries. The question he wanted to ask was,
"Okay, Coach, what are you thinking?"
The internet was rife with speculations about where his coach was headed, but every blog seemed to agree that Lonnie Britt was leaving Central. Sully shrugged and said,
"I don't want to leave, Coach, but timing is everything, you know."
"Have you talked to an agent?"
"Not yet. There are runners all around bugging me, bugging Murray, but I haven't spoken to an agent yet. You think I should?"
Lonnie nodded, as did Jason Grinnell.
"You need an agent, Samuel," Lonnie said. "But be careful."
Sully absorbed this with a poker face. He knew damned well that Lonnie himself had an agent and that they were aggressively pursuing openings around the country. His agent was a slick operator from Houston who repped a lot of college basketball coaches. According to the online dirt, and there was a pile of it, Price was trying to manipulate searches at Purdue, Marquette, and several other schools involved in the annual postseason game of musical chairs.
"I'm hesitant to recommend an agent, Samuel," Lonnie said. "There are a lot of them, and I don't have much experience. I'm getting calls."
Jason Grinnell laughed and said,
"We're all getting calls, Samuel. Every agent in the country, certified or not, is calling and trying to get a foot in the door. I've never had so many friends."
The laughter died, and an awkward pause followed. Finally, Sully asked,
"So, what am I supposed to do? Do you think I'm ready for the draft? Or should I stay in school?"
Lonnie smiled and said,
"You're every bit as good as the players you faced in the tournament. We believe in you and want you to succeed. Sure, I'd love to coach you for 3 more years, but that's not going to happen. You can't say no to the money, Samuel."
"What's going to happen to you?"
"I don't know. Lots of rumors, but I'm in no hurry. You, on the other hand, need to make a decision."
"Do you know Ernie Savage?"
"Never met him, but he's rumored to be a decent agent."
"Why?" "His runner has been persistent. Showed up at Norfolk, then again in Memphis after we beat Duke. Said hello to Murray and wanted to get together."
"Murray didn't tell me."
"No, sir, he didn't tell me either. The contact was unauthorized, but as I've learned, it's really no big deal. Just the runner. I've checked out Savage, and he seems to be legit. Has 2 dozen or so players in the NBA.
Lonnie asked, "You want me to make phone calls?"
"No, sir, but thanks." I'm digging for myself, plus Murray's got my back.
Jason said,
"You gotta do it, Sully.
You can't say no to the money."
"I know."
Murray sat at the kitchen table with his parents and sipped a soda. No food was present. There was nothing doing on the stove or in the oven, not a whiff of the usual delicious aroma. Ida was perturbed and had been for some time. She was saying, "He's not even 19 years old. You gotta be 19, right?"
"Sort of. You have to turn 19 in the calendar year you're drafted."
"That's too young," she said.
"That's the rule, Mom. And what's the big deal anyway? What about baseball and hockey? Every year, hundreds of 18-year-olds turn pro right out of high school. Been doing it for years, for decades. Al Kaline won the American League batting title when he was 20 years old. Joe Nuxall pitched his first game for the Reds at the age of 15.
"Who?" Ida asked.
"And those old white guys are somehow relevant to Sully and the NBA?
Ernie asked.
"No, they're not. My point is that 18 and 19-year-olds go pro all the time now. Duke has 3 or 4 of them this year. Kentucky has at least 2. Why do you think those guys are more mature than Sully?"
"He's just a kid," Ida said, again.
"I can't believe we're talking about this."
"Get with him, Mom. He needs to sign with an agent and enter the draft."
Ernie was shaking his head.
"I don't like it. He needs to finish college and then think about going pro."
Murray said,
"I disagree. What if there's $1 million on the table? And he says no, comes back to Central, then gets hurt. Why take that chance? All Sully wants is to make some money that will enable him to go get his family. That's what he thinks about. Sure, a college degree would be nice, and he plans to get one sooner or later, but he will not sleep well until his mother and brothers are over here safe and sound."
Ida said,
"He's not going to make $1 million, is he?"
Murray smiled while shaking his head in frustration.
"Mom, I know you don't follow the game online, and that's a good thing. But right now, most experts and bloggers are picking Sully to go mid to late first round, probably between the 15th and 20th picks. On something known as the rookie scale contract, that means his first year guaranteed salary is about $2 million. Double that for year 2.
Ida shook her head in disbelief.
Ernie said, "He can't even drive a car."
"Well, I'm teaching him. In a few months, he'll own a Porsche."
"God help us."
Reynard Owen sat in a booth and watched a cold rain sprinkle the parking lot. The restaurant was on the outskirts of Chapel Hill, 25 minutes from Central's campus. On time, the small blue pickup pulled into the lot and parked next to Reynard's sleek black Jaguar. From the passenger side, Sully got out, unfolded himself, and looked at the Jaguar. Murray got out and admired it, too. One of them said something funny, and both laughed as they crossed the parking lot. Inside, Reynard waved them over, and they met in a booth, far away from anyone else. Everything about Reynard was cool. The tailored jacket, designer frames, gold Rolex. He exuded success and wealth beyond his 30 years, but that was expected. Sully and Murray, a couple of broke college kids, were impressed, but they knew they were supposed to be. Reynard was nothing more than a salesman, a runner sent by his boss to break the ice with a potential client. They talked about the tournament, and Reynard asked if they were over the loss to Villanova. No, they were not. They ordered burgers and fries, and when the waitress left, Murray said, "Let's get on with the business here, okay? Sully and I need to get back to the library and study all night."
They were cutting classes right and left. The madness had left them with hangovers, and they were still distracted by it. Plus, the Sully story wasn't going away and now centered on the kid turning pro.
Reynard flashed his perfect smile and said, "Sure. My boss is Arnie Savage, a cool guy about 45, played sparingly for Gonzaga decades ago, one of the top agents in the business. I'm sure you've checked him out and could name his NBA lineup."
Both Sully and Murray nodded. Yes, they could.
"Arnie gets top dollar, but all agents say that. Actually, the money is not a big issue at this stage because it's controlled by the players' union. The old guys don't want the young guys to get all the money.
I'm sure you're familiar with the rookie scale contract.
Both nodded.
Depending on where you go in the first round, Arnie will negotiate a 4-year deal with the first two guaranteed.
Murray said,
The first round? Are you and Arnie sure he'll go in the first round?
Murray, look, if Arnie wasn't convinced, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. He has enough clients already, so he doesn't fool with guys down the draft, okay? Arnie's all about the relationship. He cares deeply about his players and becomes their close friend, their confidant. He'd rather spend time with his players than try to hustle a contract for some kid to play in Europe. You understand?
They nodded.
Don't get me wrong. He has clients in Europe, some great players over there, and he works hard to get them back over here where, just maybe, they belong. But most of his work is with the NBA.
They kept nodding.
Other than the friendship and advice, Arnie earns his money with the marketing and endorsements. It's not unusual for one of his clients to make more money off the court than in the games. He's shrewd and understands the real market value of his players,
Sully said.
And the more we make, the more he makes?
Absolutely. He takes 4% off the top of your playing contract, same as all agents. Right now, he has $200 million in cumulative salaries, so the math gets easy. He's annually ranked in the top 10 sports agents. What you don't always see are the deals for endorsements.
Murray was nodding along as if he knew all this. Top 5, 26 players in the NBA, 4 All-Stars. Sully's head was spinning. It was exciting enough to see his name tossed around by bloggers playing the draft game. He caught himself dreaming of having plenty of money. But now, sitting across from a man who could connect him to his dreams, he was overwhelmed. Their platters arrived, but all three ignored the food. Reynard was saying, What Arnie wants is this.
Let's go see him. You need to meet Arnie and let him give you the full picture. He can map out the next 5 years of your life, and he can make it happen.
Where is he?
Murray asked.
Miami, South Beach. He likes warm weather.
He nodded at the window and said,
Sure beats this crap. They're talking rain for the next 3 days.
Is that your Jag out there?
Murray asked.
It is. Maryland plates.
D.C. I cover this part of the country for Arnie.
How many guys are on the force?
There are 4 of us, and we travel a lot, especially this time of the year. Watch a lot of games, see a lot of film, tons of networking.
You like it?
Love it.
Murray was intrigued. A future in the NBA looked doubtful for him. Perhaps he might pursue the agent thing.
Sully asked,
When does Mr. Savage want to see us?
Oh, he'll fly up here. And no one calls him Mr. Savage. He's just Arnie. But it would be much more fun to go down there. He's got a cool place and there's always a party. He'll send a jet and we'll be there in no time.
A private jet?
Murray asked.
Sure. He's got a couple.
They were in. Chapter 52.
Echo Lamb was in town. He said he just happened to be passing through. The truth was, he was needed by 2 of his friends. The first was young Samuel. Echo picked him up at the dorm early on a Friday morning and drove to a diner in downtown Durham. As they took their seats at a table, Echo said,
Good grief, son, are you still growing?
Feels like it, Sully said with a grin. Haven't been measured lately.
How much do you weigh?
Not enough. Guess who I had a long talk with last night?
Niolo?
Sully laughed and said,
How'd you know?
You told me to guess.
I guess I got it right.
What did he say?
Take the money and run. Said my stock might never be higher. Said there's always the possibility of injuries and so on. He played 1 year at Syracuse, entered the draft at age of 19, and was a 7th overall pick.
They ordered coffee, juice, and eggs. Echo nodded along. This was old news. He had known Niolo for 15 years.
Sully continued. He said the first year is pretty rough, but it's the same for everyone. It takes a while for your body to adjust to an 82-game schedule, but he thinks I'm mature enough to physically handle it. Rumors are he's leaving Miami. We didn't talk about that. Figured it was none of my business. I asked about agents and he didn't say much. I got the impression he's not too crazy about his.
Well, Samuel, I guess that settles it. If Niolo says go pro, then that's what you'll do, right?
What's your opinion?
I have a bias in favor of education. I'm very proud of my degree from Kent State because it's the first in my family. If I had things my way, I'd like to see you go to medical school and become a doctor, then go home and build hospitals.
They would just burn them down. That's 10 more years of study, Echo. Then I'd make a good living, but not millions.
So you're dreaming of millions.
That's what the game pays now.
Crazy money, isn't it?
Indeed.
I prefer education, Samuel, but let's be honest. I did not have the option of playing in the NBA. My amazing talents were not appreciated. To the surprise of no one, I went undrafted, so I became a coach.
And I'm so glad you did. What if we'd never met?
That's too awful to think about.
I know. I read an article about myself last night. These days, there are enough of them. Guy writes for ESPN. Good writer. And he said that in the history of basketball, no player has ever come so far in 12 months. Size, skill, maturity, mileage, all the yardsticks, along with the tragedies. A year ago, I stood 6'2" and was playing on dirt courts in the African bush. Now I'm 6'8" and headed for the first round.
So, you enjoy reading about yourself?
Echo was amused.
Sometimes. I like to see what they get wrong. Some guys just make up facts, you know? And Murray scans the internet collecting stories.
As I say too often, Samuel, savor the moment.
It wouldn't be wise to turn down the money, would it, Echo?
No. You gotta do it, Samuel. Everybody says you'll go in the first round. I certainly think so. You can't turn down the money.
I know. The best way to help my family is to make the money and meet important people. That's not going to happen here at Central.
I'm with you, Samuel.
Lonnie closed and locked his office door. He sat behind his desk and stared at Echo, who was smiling. Finally, Lonnie said,
I don't want to leave. I love these kids. I recruited them, made them promises, watched them grow up. Had a hell of a ride with them last month. How am I supposed to tell them I'm leaving?
Every coach has to do it, Lonnie.
It's just part of the business. It'll be rough and everybody will have a good cry. Then the new guy will come in and they'll forget about you. That's life.
I know, I know.
This is what you've dreamed of and worked for. You've earned it, Lonnie. It's time for a big promotion.
Have I earned it? Sully was a once-in-a-lifetime miracle. Take him away, and we were headed for a losing season. I didn't develop the kid. He turned into some sort of freak who got hot and almost conquered the world. The rest of us were just along for the ride.
You've won 20 games a year for 5 straight years. In this business, that gets you a promotion and a nice raise.
A hell of a raise. 10 times what I'm making now.
I rest my case.
What about Agnes?
You kidding? She wants the money.
Then take it and stop whining. Why can't I take Sully with me?
Because last night he got a call from Niolo, who told him he was old enough to play in the NBA, said take the money and run. He's running now.
Good for him.
They were quiet for a long time and somber. Lonnie could not imagine calling a team meeting and saying goodbye. By now his players knew they would lose Sully. Losing their coach would crush them.
He said, truthfully, Agnes is not crazy about moving to Milwaukee. She got enough snow when we were at Northern Iowa. The kids are happy in school here, and they'll be happy wherever you go. Don't worry about the snow because the planet is warming, in case you haven't heard.
Come on, Lonnie. Marquette is big-time basketball, and they're offering you a fortune. You're 40 years old, and you're going places. How many times have we had this conversation?
I know.
Lonnie glanced at his watch. Echo did the same and said, I want a nice lunch in some swanky place. It's my turn to get the check, but I'm broke and you're wealthy now, so it's on you.
Okay, okay.
For at least the third time in a tense standoff, Murray reminded his father that he was 20 years old and capable of making his own decisions. And if he wanted to spend the weekend on South Beach with Samuel and others, then he would certainly do so. He was old enough to vote, join the army, buy a car if he could only afford one, and sign other contracts, and well, there. So be it. They were in Ernie's cramped office at the downtown food bank. Ernie thought the trip was a bad idea, as did Miss Ida. Both had said no, and Murray was chafing under their efforts to supervise. He had chosen to confront his father because Ernie was the softer touch. A no from Ida had greater authority. But it didn't matter. The boys were leaving. Murray said goodbye and slammed the door on the way out. Ernie waited half an hour and called his wife. They were losing sleep over the prospect of Samuel leaving school and entering the draft. They had practically raised him in the past 8 months and had become his family. He was a smart kid, but not mature enough to make such important decisions. The money might ruin him. Sharks out there could manipulate him. The temptations would be great. He was just a simple kid who couldn't even drive a car and certainly wasn't ready for fame and fortune.